The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
How are you going to fund punishment? And one answer is, the less you punish, the less you have to fund. So if we scale back, it's much less expensive. Then the actual question is, how much does it really cost? And one version is, how much does it cost to build bricks and mortar? And another question is, how much does it cost to the people who are involved? Prison staff have higher anxiety, depression, heart attacks, blood pressure, because any of us who walk into a prison are struck by noise, congestion, metal, concrete. For people who work in prisons, as well as people who live in prisons, they are terrible environments.
Hi, and welcome to The Hearing. I am Tanae Frazier, your host for this week's episode. And today I spoke with Professor Judith Resnick. Professor Resnick is the professor of law at Yale University. She is also the founder of the Arthur Lyman Center for Public Interest Law Program, which is named after Arthur Lyman, the author of the 1972 Attica Report, detailing the 1971 Attica prison uprising. Professor Resnick is a leading scholar on social justice. She is also the author of the recent book, Impermissible Punishments: How Prison Became a Problem for Democracy. In this episode, we discuss her book, The History of Punishments, and the progression of the corrections profession as a whole. What I really found fascinating about her book and the research she did was how she took a transatlantic approach to showcasing the history of permissible and impermissible punishments across the Atlantic. She also showcased what governments have done, their approach to punishment, and the progression of the corrections profession. Professor Resnick does a masterful job of retelling the stories of the brave individuals that shaped the prison system as we know it today, especially the prisoners. She discusses the theorists, the correctional professionals, the attorneys, the judges, and also the politicians, all who played a pivotal role in this movement. During this episode, we discuss common punishments leaning into the corporal punishment, forced labor, solitary confinement. We also talk about the evolution of prisoners' rights and some of the different legal challenges that determine what was considered constitutional and unconstitutional punishments. We talk a little bit about the cost of prisons and how overcriminalization has led to an increase in those costs. Then we mention how this establishment, the prison system, is having an effect on not just the incarcerated, but also on the people that work there, the correctional staff. Professor Resnick challenges us to rethink how we view punishments and the prison system as a whole. She implores us to remain cognizant and accountable for the punishment we inflict on others.
The Hearing.
Thank you for joining me today, Professor Resnick. Professor Resnick, you've been heralded as a champion and a scholar for social justice, and recently you wrote the book Impermissible Punishments: How Prison Became a Problem for Democracy. I had the honor of reading this masterfully written work before its publication date, and I must say that the contents of it have not only changed my view, but they've lingered with me. But before we get into our discussion about your book, please share with me a little bit about your legal background and what inspired you to write this book.
Well, first of all, thank you. I'm delighted, as I told you, to have a readership, which is, of course, why I wrote the book, was to have people engage with the problem of what draws the line between some ways in which we can punish people and how come we can't. In terms of the book, I teach law at Yale Law School. I helped found the Arthur Lyman Public Interest Center, which is for which enables graduates of the law school to work for a year doing useful work at a modest income for lawyers for a year. And we have undergraduates around the country as well in summer fellowships. And I've, over the course of all my life, worried and thought about how states, governments that are democratic, relate to and are obliged to relate to the people who are their residents and citizens. In the context of that, I teach classes on parts of the U.S. Constitution, on the structure of adjudication, on law, litigation, courts, government services, post offices, prisons, the things governments do, a little bit about roads, not as much as I should. And in the context of that, I read a case from the 1960s called Talley v. Stevens, in which, in that case and one right thereafter, when Arkansas prisoners went to federal judges and said, "Stop Arkansas from whipping me," federal judges said, "You can whip as long as you don't do it arbitrarily and no more than 10 lashes at a time." And then in 1968, when Harry Blackmun was a Court of Appeals judge on the Eighth Circuit before he went to the Supreme Court, he wrote a long opinion that held that whipping was impermissible, unconstitutional, cruel and unusual punishment. And I was struck first that three federal judges said it was okay at the lower court level, and second, that it wasn't a two-paragraph, "Of course, stop the whip, it's disgusting." But instead, what happened instead is that there was a long opinion in which the judges, three of them, described how important it was to draw the line and why there were nine reasons why whipping was no good. So I wanted to reverse engineer it, if you will, and try to figure out what made it hard. And in the context of that, I came upon something called the Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners, promulgated by the League of Nations in 1934. And here we are, a transnational organization, the first international one aiming to help generate peace. And it's got these dozens of rules about light and air in prisons. And when you come to the category of discipline, it says, in exceptional cases, you can use corporal punishment, by which they meant whipping. You can put people in dark rooms. You can deprive them of food.
Shocking.
And they introduce their rules by saying these are coming from a humanitarian and social point of view. And then I say, where is law in the story? And in the rules about discipline, it says, in accordance with law. So law gets a mention. And it says also, before you do any of these awful things, check with the doctors, check with medical officials to see whether it's too gruesome a harm. And I thought, where does this come from? How did, and where, and I am a law professor, where is law in this story? And where did law come in, and how did it come in? So that prompted my inquiry into my into what became this book, which is a transnational account of the world of punishment, transatlantic, let me be clear. It's a focus on Europe and the United States. And there's a certain potential, of course, with a horrible history of U.S. enslavement, to think that the whipping story is a U.S. Southern story. It's not a U.S., it is a U.S. Southern story, and it is also England, by statute, authorized what it called birching for people under 18, and then there was lashing. It's not something that is confined to one part of the U.S. as an in-prison or as a punishment for people who have broken, alleged or found to have broken laws. And so that's the prompt that got me to the book. And as you know, there's a much longer and thicker set of materials, but let me just stop by saying there's the first answer.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Now, your answer to my first question leads me into this question. And normally I would ask you this at the end of our discussion, but in this case, I think it's more suitable for us to begin our discussion with this question instead. What do you want others to gain from reading Impermissible Punishments? What is your overall goal for this book?
First, that figuring out how to punish people has been a question that only became a question in the 1700s. Flashback to when monarchs could do whatever they wanted. and worry about where we are in the United States now. The idea was, and here we have to give credit to fancy philosophers who were also political activists, by the way, and punishment abolitionists. So a guy named Beccaria in Italy in 1764, and a guy named Bentham in England a little couple decades later, start making arguments that punishment needs to be justified.
Yes.
Not random, not arbitrary, but utilitarian, useful, deter, incapacitate, reform, correct, redeem, whole bunch of arguments. But just pause to appreciate a conceptual shift that says you can't just willy-nilly punish. You got to have a good reason. So that's penal in today's U.S. constitutional parlance. It's penal, legitimate penological purposes or aims or goals. Justify. And let's thank them for requiring justification. They also had ideas about constraints. They were, Beccaria is famous for saying proportionality, make it relate, don't just kill everybody. And he's also super famous for saying stop the death penalty and capital punishment. So he's an abolitionist for capital punishment. Bentham hates what he calls transportation, which is exiling people to the colonies.
Yes.
And he hates that in part because he wants punishment to be useful. He's a thoroughgoing utilitarian. And he says, how's it going to be useful? Not if you ship them away. You got to show us what punishment is to make us rational actors be deterred from doing bad things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the utilitarian example. Show us. Be in public. Watch it. Or when he famously proposes a prison called the Panopticon that wasn't built, he wants a watchtower in the middle. He wants an amusement park on the grounds. He wants people to come and watch that it's bad to be punished, so we won't punish. That's his view.
Mm-hmm.
So step one is justifying punishment. Walk away from this book realizing that punishment was once willy-nilly. We're at risk of it becoming that again, and don't let it happen. Step two is punishments change. Don't think that the system we have now is inevitable, nor is it natural. In response to trying to stop branding, transportation, capital punishment, the replacement punishments, as they called them, the alternative was incarceration. If you go back and read, which is not so fun or easy to do, all the details of Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon, he's got food, he's got health care, he's got a medical official, he's got the person who he calls the governor or our warden, the person in head. When people die, the guy loses salary because he's supposed to be protecting the welfare of the people who are in his custody. So what we currently have as prison is not inevitable. It's been made with a whole lot of thought. So that's step two. Punishment can change. It has changed. It can change again. Step three is appreciate that just as Bentham and Beccaria are taught in schools as famous political theorists, so should people like Winston Talley and William Jackson and Caleb Washington and Thomas X. Cooper, because these are incarcerated people in the 1960s who say, stop the whip, or stop solitary confinement, or stop segregating me by race, or stop punishing me because I'm a member of the, I am a member of the Islam faith. And they go to federal court, and because they're in the midst of the civil rights movement, they are able to get judges' attention and get into court on the argument that the U.S. Constitution has something to say about conditions of confinement. And here is they are theorists of punishment. They have a new theory of punishment, not just deter or scare or incapacitate or rehabilitate. Their theory of punishment is that as human beings, as rights holders, they have the power to stop the sovereign. They don't say they didn't do something wrong. They're not saying, stop my sentence. They're saying, you can't treat me like this because I, like you, are a human being with rights under the U.S. and in some instances, the transnational constitutional order. And that's a new idea about not how, why punishment should occur, but how it has to occur in the present. So one thing to think through is to remember that retributives say, I'm punishing you for the bad. Utilitarians say, I want to deter you for the future. So I got past and future. These brilliant prisoners understand that their present is relevant and that there are limits on sovereign power to punish in the present, not only in the future. And so, and I guess the other takeaway is, appreciate the transnationalism of the story, the transatlantic, the idea that the U.S. is not an insular pod, however much we want to pretend we are. Yeah. It the shift that gets legal international recognition of prisoners' rights occurs in the wake of World War II concentration camps and the U.S. civil rights movement. And it is the horrific analogies between enslavement, concentration camps, and incarceration that generate a universal commitment to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which gives everybody rights and dignity. And so the appreciation that it's not just an Arkansas story, it's not just a U.S. story, it's a transnational story, and that gets us right back to the present, which is in the present, it has to be a transnational commitment that everybody has to be treated with respect for their humanity, whether they're convicted, whether they're alleged to be entering unlawfully, whatever it is. And so the last purpose is to be incredibly both worried and mobilized on the grounds that we're watching a new embrace of a degradation that was rejected in the wake of World War II.
Now, you've mentioned transatlantic, transnational a couple of times, and I really want to hone in on why you decided to take that approach when writing your book discussing these punishments. Why was that the aim instead of just centering it on what we know of punishment in the United States?
Thank you. It's because it isn't just a U.S. story. There are particulars in every country. And so there are books about England and why England was incredibly grossly punitive in the 1800s and shaved people's heads and put them on treadwheels and the like. And there are books about France and there are books about all the countries. I am limited by my language. I can read French and English and I can read things. And I have amazing students who translate from some other languages. So I'm focused on both sides of the Atlantic. And the book is partially an account of the invention of what was a new profession called corrections. Didn't exist. It came into being. First, there were all these punishments like branding and transportation. As prisons and jails grew in their girths and numbers of people they were housing, mostly people who ran them either described themselves as philanthropists or they became prison men, prison managers, and they were patronage jobs. And over time, people who were running prisons sought to professionalize, sought to improve. There were the societies for the protection of prisoners, religious and not, that grew up all on both sides of the Atlantic. And over time, they scaled up to create a distinct profession. And just a historical footnote, we're in the middle of creating the social sciences. There wasn't sociology, there wasn't psychology, there wasn't anthropology. All of those are coming into being in social science terms. And there are people who call themselves criminologists, what should we penalize? And then there's these people called corrections that say, we're expert at keeping people safe. And give us money, give us authority, and let us run your prisons. And be clear, some of what they want is air and light and decent confinement. They also naturalize incredible control over human beings. Stunning micro control. And that's, we should be shocked, like really shocked. And the shock should go from on both sides of the Atlantic at the minute daily control. There's a guy in France who writes only in French, and so he's not much read here in the 1860s. He says he wants education. He wants a script every 15 minutes of a human being in confinement's day to control them completely. And because he thinks they're all lower class people, he doesn't want to give them too much education because they shouldn't expect more than they're supposed to get. So the idea of generating a profession of seeking to do improvement, but as accepting and making normal what we should see as so not normal. Think, put yourself, any of us who are listening, or you and me here, we're in a room. My room is about, I don't know, 8 by 12 or something, and I've got windows, and I can get up and move around. Imagine putting someone, as we do in solitary confinement, in a space the size of a parking lot, and telling them they can't for days or months or years move beyond that space. How do we make that up? And why isn't that plainly impermissible? Of course, I think it is. So the reason to be telling a transnational story is that it is, this stuff came from really interesting meetings. I welcome people if they have energy and appetite. However long my book is, it's way shorter than the thousands of pages of the each year's reports in 1870 in Cincinnati. Future Governor Rutherford B. Hayes welcomes the delegates, 350 people, to the first National Prison Congress of the United States. And 2 years later in London, the first International Congress takes place. And from 1872 London till 1951 at The Hague, 1950 at The Hague, in the Netherlands, there are these annual, these five-year congresses of something called the International Penal and Penitentiary Commission that drafted the League of Nations rules. I need to add another comment, which is that, so these meetings occurred of this international organization every 5 years. They're interrupted by the tragedy of World War I. And when they resume in London in 1925, they have a meeting in which they re-champion their authority to run prisons and modernize them and make them fine. And at the meeting are people, including women from the Howard League, which is a reformist league in England and has branches elsewhere, to do prison reform. And a group of great feminists, Marjorie Fry, Cecily Craven, others, are come to that meeting and walk away with documentation of the horrors of prisons in more than one part of the world. And they say, we need to create an international convention for prisoners' rights, their word rights, because prison can be torture, their word torture. And they are astute, brilliant political actors. They've known incarcerated people, including suffragettes. And they lobby the League of Nations. As they're lobbying the League of Nations, the International Penal Penitentiary Commission, the people who run prisons, realize that they better take the project up. But when they take the project up and they draft these rules, they don't use the word rights and they don't use the word torture. And so the glimpse of a rights-based international convention existed in the 1920s after World War I, and then after World War II, when the International Penal Penitentiary Commission is dissolved because it's been not expelling fascists. It says being a prison manager is not political. Excuse me, there's politics in the decision about how to treat every human being, wherever you are. Then, it's then that the United Nations promulgates in 1955 its first standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners. And those rules use the words rights and dignity and ban corporal punishment. And it is that shift that brings us to the last 70 years on both sides of the Atlantic and elsewhere, in which the question is, What does the word rights mean when somebody's in detention or being punished? And that is also another point of this book. In addition to appreciating the creation of corrections, the history of purposeful punishment, the brilliance of the prisoners who interrupt and insist that there's another missing piece of the punishment obligation, which is to treat them with respect and dignity as people. It's also, okay, what do we do now, and how do we make sense of a concept of rights if we're limiting people's autonomy in any way?
Now, you've mentioned the Talley cases, and that's when the United States begins to discuss what is considered constitutional. That's when constitutional law begins to make its entrance into how these prisoners are treated. Can you expound on that some?
Sure. Let's go through a couple of the steps. Right after the Civil War, Congress creates what we in law call Section 1983, which is after the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, there is a right people can go to court and say a person acting under color of state law is violating my constitutional rights. However, that had a very narrow reach until the 1960s. And the first Supreme Court case that gives it new life is a case called Monroe v. Pape. And in that case, Chicago police gruesomely attack some people in an apartment in Chicago, Illinois, all too salient now in terms of physical violence against residents of places. And the U.S. Supreme Court says, without mentioning that all the police are white and the people being barged into are black, a black family, that those police officers, whether authorized by a statute, had a badge, and they were acting under color of state law, and therefore they could be subject to liability, could be defendants in lawsuits under Section 1983. Early 60s. Step two, enter Thomas X. Cooper, who is also in Illinois prisons. And if you read his papers, any of us who are lawyers can only be utterly impressed by his erudition and elegance as a legal writer. And he files a lawsuit because he's been put in solitary confinement in the Illinois prison system because he's a Muslim and subjected to awful treatment. And he brings a lawsuit, and the U.S. Supreme Court, again, without mentioning the background facts I've just given, said, yes, prison officials are also acting under color of state law, and they can be defendants in these cases. So those two cases in the U.S. Supreme Court open the door for Winston Talley, who's a white guy in Arkansas, along with his two co-plaintiffs, because Arkansas was beating all the people in its system, disproportionately black, but black and white men made to pick okra and cucumbers and cotton. If they didn't make their amount, or they were in any way seen and, or for whatever reason, arbitrary, they could be whipped. So Talley smuggles his papers out, gets into court. Credit to the district court judge, Chief Judge Henley, Eastern District, Arkansas. In 1965, he appoints the best lawyers in the state in terms of the heads of the Bar Association of the state of Arkansas to represent these prisoners, because there are two others who joined Talley. And he first says, yes, you have a right to get into court, see Cooper's case, but you don't have a right to not be subjected to what the prison officials tell us they absolutely need to keep discipline. Except what you can't do is whip more than 10 at a time, lashes at a time, and you have to have rules. And other prisoners who are called trustees, a terrible word for what they did, are not allowed to whip each other. Appreciate that at the time in Arkansas, whipping was a political issue in the governor's races. And so it is very possible that Judge Henley thought that his opinion, making it harder to whip, coupled with popular concerns. Arkansas newspapers wrote about this and said it was awful. And Governor Forbes, who said, I'm not for this either, he might have thought, Henley, that by making it harder, he would have had, they would have just stopped using it. Didn't turn out that way. And please put this in context. Remember that Arkansas is where Little Rock, where the civil rights school desegregation center is, and where there is enormous resistance to federal power and to civil rights by some segments of the population. Not everybody in Little Rock, but some. So here we are in that same place, and a federal judge authorizes the prisoners to sue, recognizes their authority, but then doesn't go and ban, although he tries to constrain whipping. Within a year, as there's disgusting, I'm sorry, I use these words too often in this, but I am trying to be not saying awful things, but alluding to awful treatment. The state police in Arkansas investigate the Arkansas prisons and learn that the people running them were literally using all different forms of torture. We know food deprivation and filth and whipping can be called torture. So can electric shocks and other gross, gross behavior. So there's an expose that's in the newspapers that comes to light. And once again, there's a hope that with this information, there will be a stop the whip. The next piece is William Jackson files another lawsuit saying the tally rules are not being obeyed, those limits that Judge Henley, Chief Judge Henley put on. And furthermore, please stop it altogether. Three prisoners file. They're before two different district court judges, Gordon and Young. The judges consolidate the cases at the request of the lawyers they appoint, and they appoint another two stellar leaders of the bar. One of them, Edward Wright, goes on to be the president of the American Bar Association. So these are as fancy, famous, established, authoritative lawyers as the state of Arkansas has. And by doing so, the judges are taking and acknowledging the importance of the prisoners' claims. And this time, and I think it's the only transcript of a whipping trial in U.S. history, those judges listen for 3 days of testimony about the constitutionality of whipping. And here's the repeated explanations by the prison staff about how they need to whip, how they were whipped, how they whipped their kids, and why whipping's okay. And then you also hear from a person who had run the Federal Bureau of Prisons, a man named James Bennett, and James Bennett says, it's medieval to whip, and we don't whip. And the person who runs the Missouri prison system, Fred Wilkinson, says it's medieval to whip. We don't whip either. So, but those two trial judges end up saying they can whip as long as there's more procedural protection. And it's that case that goes to the Court of Appeals in the Eighth Circuit, and that's when Judge Blackmun says you can't whip. And that's where he writes, how will we be able to tell the difference between the impermissible or not? And the sentences in the context in which somebody's making an argument that a whip without studs is okay and a whip with studs isn't. And he recoils at drawing that distinction. But I'm inviting people to recoil at many of the other things we think of as natural or normal or comes with the thing called prison. There's nothing normal about it. And don't think for a minute that many of those things should be permissible forms of punishment.
The hearing.
You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence, be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
As allegiances are tested.
You're gambling with World War III.
And regimes fall.
Fighters and civilians continue to stream in from other parts of Syria.
No matter where the story is,
Reuters World News podcast is there. We make sense of the news shaping our world and give you everything you need to know in a 10-minute podcast every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
When I was reading your book, I was stunned by the illustrations where you showed the thickness of the strap that was used to whip the prisoners. When you showed a lot of the different punishments, gruesome as they were, displayed, it's one thing to hear it and read it, but there's another thing to see it illustrated in front of you. And it was just shocking, to say the least. And I know that you're mentioning some of the gruesome punishments, but one of the things that, as you say, you recoil was when there was the teeter telephone, when they were using the phone to give electric shocks to the prisoners. Inhumane is not even the word to use when thinking about these punishments that the prisoners had to endure.
In different parts of the book, I sometimes say, you know, there's a trigger warning in our current parlance. What's important is both out of respect to the people who suffered to describe some of what happened to them. It's also important I use the newspapers. Arkansas had and has amazing local coverage. The Arkansas Gazette and the Arkansas Democrat ran daily stories. Some of the pictures in the book come, with the thanks to the publishers of the newspapers, from the archives of those newspapers. And it is important to appreciate that it is known and seen. And some people recoil, and I'm sorry to say other people didn't. So the terrible parallel now are the grotesque pictures of the El Salvador prisons and the descriptions of alligator Arcatraz, or Arcatraz alligator, whichever you want to call it. And today, some segments of the government are embracing the degradation that was rejected at a formal level across the world. And I just want to use the words formal for a moment. I'm not starry-eyed for a second. You're sitting in Alabama, I believe. I'm sitting in New York, where Attica was. That my book deals with Ohio, California, prisons all over the United States, Illinois, Arkansas. Pick your state. There have been both challenges and post the 1960s, terrible, terrible treatment inside the United States and outside the United States. Draw the distinction between not making good on the ground what you say you should be doing and realize that is better than saying what we're hearing now, which is you don't have to treat people with safety and dignity. You don't have to provide safety and you don't have to treat people with dignity. So I want to both be distressed at how often implementation doesn't happen. And indeed, in the book, I give you the story of when the prisoners win the Arkansas after the whipping case. I'm going to slow down and say a few different things. Step one, the whipping is the first in the United States that I know of in which a mode of punishment is banned for the whole system expressly. In other words, it's not you can't whip him, it's you can't whip at all. That's 1968. 2 years later, in 1970, Judge Henley, who started it in 1965, holds the entire Arkansas prison system unconstitutional as a dark and evil world that is filthy, unsafe. There are people called creepers who are stabbing other prisoners. He goes through a very long, horrific set of examples. So that's 1970. And from 1970 to 1982, when the case is finally ended, there are fits and starts of implementation and not. We haven't talked about money yet, and I think we need to. Arkansas before 1968 had no budget line in its system, in its budget, for prisoners. It didn't have very good social services for anybody, but it didn't have any line for prisoners because it was all sweat labor. They were supposed to work unending hours with terrible equipment in degrading situations and make a, quote, profit for the state.
That's right.
Starting in 68 and moving forward around the United States, prisons get some funding under the rubric of obligations for some degree of safety, some quality of food, some health care, some. So that's the umbrella of U.S. constitutional rights. Not implemented by any stretch, but different than it was when there was no doctor, or when Texas had one doctor for 17,000 people, as is in the record in one other case. The distinction right now, which we should not lose sight of, is however disappointed and whatever work needs to be done to make true on what we haven't accomplished, we are living under a regime now that says it's okay to treat people terribly and deliberately degrade them. And that should put us all into a place of committed resistance to degrading us all by saying in our name, other people can be terribly treated. And we have the horrific examples, both inside this country and elsewhere, of what that means in practice.
That is a great point. And I want to pull back a little bit to some of the historic accounts of punishment that you mentioned earlier. You mentioned in the book that baselines played a role in what was considered permissible. And here we are now living in this time frame where it seems that some of the normalization of the awful forms of punishment are still reckoning now. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Psychologists use the word framing or anchoring. How do we think about what's okay and what's not? And we start from where we are. There's a quote I love from Pablo Picasso, who, when he said there's no such thing as abstract art, you always start with something. In other words, you always have in your head something that frames or anchors or shapes what you can expect.
Mm-hmm.
And if you lived in a world where there was no radical solitary confinement, you would be stunned the same way that you are stunned at that disgusting thick whip that's in the pages of the newspaper. So your point, which I think is important, is we need to keep the baselines we've made of dignity, rights, and human beingness for all people, which is where I offer the words anti-ruination as a way to describe the claims that prisoners made when they said, you can't treat me like this. So if I go back again, the U.S. Supreme Court says, oh, you can't segregate by race anymore. Alabama had statutes that said black and white men can't be chained together or sleep together. Off the table, right? The U.S. Supreme Court, at least for now, has put off the table putting someone in prison because they couldn't pay a $5 fine. You can't substitute prison for fines and have people so-called work it off at indentured spaces. Okay. Over time, the U.S. Supreme Court and lower courts and statutes have also taken off the table no medical care, grotesque food, zero sanitary conditions. All those things are off the table. I just read the complaint filed by the ACLU on behalf of an individual held in Florida at something that they proudly call Alligator Alcatraz. And that description of that complaint is mosquito-infested, filthy, toilets not working, a grotesque set of conditions. So here we are at the point of saying you should never change the baselines to which you're committed, whether you can pay all you need to pay to make it true. And of course, if you can't make it true, you shouldn't be able to hold them in conditions that are grotesque. And that's took 300 years to get to this baseline of human dignity and rights bearing. And the state, my point is, the state can set out to punish people, to deter people. It can't set out to ruin them. ruins an old word in England. We're laden with England. England had whips. England had fines. But England also had this idea that you shouldn't use state power to ruin somebody. And if you couldn't ruin them economically, I want to say the best way to explain the little bit of protection that U.S. law currently has is you can't ruin them physically as well, and much more is needed. And here, just to go across the ocean and talk about the U.S. as different. Up until about the 70s or 80s, there's a lot of overlap between the U.S. and Europe in its approaches. Some European countries, not all of Europe, but the European Convention on Human Rights, the U.S. constitutional developments, a good deal of overlap. It is only starting in the 1980s as the U.S. turns away from that civil rights set of commitments, limits engagement with the discrimination based on race, and moves away from those issues, that Europe and the United States divide in rights-based issues. Before then, there's another really big distinction, which is many European countries have everybody have a right to healthcare or education or some forms of support. And so when people in prison are treated like everybody, and the words under the European prison rules from 2006 going forward are that prisoners are supposed to be in situations that regularize and normalize, and back to your baselines, normalize in relationship to the street. Not what's normal in prison, but what's normal on the streets. So because Europe uses the streets as the baseline, the European rules and many European countries, it means that people in prison are treated as close as they can to people who are not in prison, and that welfareist infrastructure is one that supports providing potentially for everyone. A simple example, I haven't been to every European country, but in the countries that I've been to, you walk into the prison, the prisoners wear their own clothes, the staff wears denim or something that marks them as different, or not. The idea of sort of being as normal as possible is just in a prison in Milan, I was told people can cook, you know, the as normal as possible to enable the return to normal life as past as possible. So we're in the middle of a fight about baselines for people inside and outside prisons, not just inside.
Mm. Now, you mentioned it just briefly, but I want to talk about the cost of prison and how forced labor, convict leasing, all of those things came into play when we're talking about the cost, because it takes money to run a prison. And there seemed to be this thought that the prisoners should have to bear that cost. And they would do that through their working or their labor that they had to expend. Could you expound on that as well?
So how are you going to fund punishment is the basic question. And one answer is the less you punish, the less you have to fund. So if we scale back, it's much less expensive. Mm-hmm. Then the actual question is, how much does it really cost? And one version is, how much does it cost to build bricks and mortar? And another question is, how much does it cost to the people who are involved? A reminder is that for people who work in prisons, as well as people who live in prisons, they are, as currently constructed in the United States, terrible environments. There is research that prison staff have higher anxiety, depression, heart attacks, blood pressure, stress-related injuries, because any of us who walk into a prison are struck by noise, congestion, metal, concrete, micromanagement as visitors, let alone as people who aren't visitors. So before we say how much is a cost, we should say, what can we do to make it less costly? And the more it's less encased and the fewer facilities there are, the less it costs. Then the next question is, the cost right now include labor, construction, and then maintenance and care of the people who are there. And so healthcare costs, I mean, all those kinds of costs. Who pays and how do you think about paying? I mentioned before that one is state taxpayer dollars. And one of the ironies of Arkansas is that once they get a budget line, they seem to have an incredible willingness to pay many, many millions to build hyper-secure facilities and not much willingness to pay for better quality for the people who are inside and to figure out fewer people. And there's just an interesting part of the book that I try to help people see the fight about who pays between the, as they are overcrowded and people are in county jails and everybody's worried about costs. So the first, keep your eye on the ball. It could cost less if you incarcerated or detained fewer people. Second, what do you do? What's the history? Of course, the history, some parts of the history are of utter idleness and warehousing where people can't do anything. And some part of the history is forced labor. And it's a mixture. And then the question is, who pays? Now, in the International Penal Penitentiary Commission in Europe in the 20s and 30s, with the influence of the International Labor Organization, called for real salaries, walk away with money, you're a laborer, and labor laws apply. In the United States, the sad tradition is that the Fair Labor Standards Act and other federal statutes don't apply. And the 13th Amendment does have words in it that have been used, except that could be read to exclude the, quote, duly convicted from protection against involuntary servitude. That doesn't mean you have to. First of all, there are different ways to read the 13th Amendment. Second, there are proposals to get a new 13th Amendment. Third, a few states have amended their equivalents to include people who are in detention. And fourth, you don't have to make it involuntary just because potentially the U.S. Constitution doesn't stop you at the door. Jeremy Bentham said, who is for capital workforces, have people like working. You want to work. You want to teach people to work because they want to, not because they're forced to. So mm-hmm. It's very dysfunctional. But of course, we've lived in a system of indentured servitude for people in detention and all too many parallels to enslavement. And just to try to nail one more piece of your question, comment, how much does it really cost to run a prison? We don't know. Because while I can count how much I paid to build it, or the state paid to healthcare or staff, how do you count the prison labor from cleaning and working in the kitchen to working anywhere else? And how do you count the family's contributions? Because there are so many people who give people who are their relatives and friends in detention funds for food, soap, phone calls, writing equipment, and the like. And so if we actually wanted to try to figure out the dollars and cents in prison, it's a genuine research project to actually have economic models to take into account the prisoners' labor and the families' contributions. To say that it's all publicly funded is to miss how much funding families put in. And remember, we live in a country with rules like pay to stay, where after you leave, somebody may try to bill you for the time you spent when you were there.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I found profound in the book was when we were talking about the forced labor and the prisoners, their labor being quantified, it was impossible to do it because even the General Accounting Office, they put into play of how much it was costing prisoners and how much it was costing to build prisons and things of that sort, but they could not account for the prisoner labor. This is something that came up in the Talley cases. One of the claims that they made was that this forced labor is unconstitutional. And they made claims under the 13th Amendment and even the 8th Amendment, but they were unsuccessful. Could you tell me why these claims were unsuccessful?
We have to lay some of the blame on the wording of the 13th and the 14th Amendment. The 13th says, mm-hmm. unless duly convicted. So it could be read to permit sentences to what's called hard labor. At the time when in addition to plantations, there is a very common in England and the United States sentence that sentences people to something called hard labor. And so the question is, does the 13th Amendment authorize judges to sentence people to hard labor, which is a suggestion that James Pope, who's written a great deal about it, a law professor, says he thinks the way to read it is it just kept in place judicial sentences to hard labor and didn't give prison officials the power to insist on hard labor. That view has not succeeded in the courts, which read the duly convicted words to say the 13th Amendment doesn't limit. If the 13th Amendment doesn't limit, it doesn't mean that we have to read the Fair Labor Standards Act as not applying, or state and local administrative materials as not applying. Aaron Littman, a law professor at UCLA, has an article about how state administrative health codes and federal and state law should be much more in use in prisons to limit the harms. And to be clear, the conflict and the complexity of how you value labor when you're insisting on it and how you price the goods produced is another challenge both for economists, and there has been, when prison systems have generated the equivalent of kinds of factories and the like, there's been some question about competition between prison-made goods and free labor goods, and how to price them, given what we hope unions succeed in doing, which is to have adequate wages and decent hours. So one answer to the question is, treat prison laborers like you treat other labor, like you should treat other laborers, limit hours, give pay, have Social Security, all of which were proposed. I'm not saying anything that anybody hasn't said. There's a guy who ran the Belgian prisons who in 1951 says exactly what I just said. Social Security, so you could do that. That's one step. The other is, can you force the people to work, or should they be optional? As when you create a system which gives people so few options, how do you generate a livable structure? And so seeking to encourage people to have daily routine and feel useful and learn things is something we would want without the retributive, punitive, you didn't work, you're going to solitary confinement kind of punchlines that we find in many U.S. prisons. If you go back and you read over the decades and even centuries, what's disheartening is it's clear that the system is harmful, and it's not news. It wasn't news to the philanthropists in the 1700s who said these people are getting sick. It isn't news in the 1980s. The federal government, U.S., puts out a series of inquiries into the prison system and says double selling is a terrible idea. Health, infection, violence, privacy, quiet, pick your variable. So to look back is to say, I'm not providing news. I'm trying to help enable people to put all the pieces together. And I'm also trying to help people see the conceptual paradigm shift from people like Winston Talley that said, yeah, you can worry about us, you can care for us, you can redeem us. We're actually also people of equal stature. And then our problem, and I mean the word our here, which I use as rarely as possible, I mean our problem is, how do you take into account people's equal stature while you are also punishing them in some way?
There is something that you ended the book with. I want to just take a moment to look at the quote, Professor Resnick, and you state that the current punishment practices must be upended, and to do so to prevent lasting injury, permanent marks. And that's something that they mentioned, like you said, you're not stating anything new, but that's something that they mentioned back in the 1700s, 1800s. It's as if we're not aware that what we're doing is not working. And I appreciate you writing this book to maybe bring it to the forefront of our minds to say, hey, we've got to do something different.
In the 1920s, when the man, he was the head of the English prison system, and he was helping to draft these standard minimum rules, and he wrote a draft that didn't make it into the rules that said no, he was focused, as England used, on these issues of being able to whip or something. But he was clear that he was trying to bound it by saying, don't leave lasting marks. And if we think about the idea, what I hope people see is that the lasting marks are on the people who are inside, on the communities from which they come from, and on the body politic, on all of us. And it's these lasting marks are dysfunctional, whether you're in or outside prison, the same way that tolerating degradation of people inside prison is not something that is confined to prison or the duly convicted. And so once we see we're all in this boat together, the question is, how can we right ship, if you will, and try to move forward? And it has to be in Justice Blackmun's tradition, drawing lines, but putting a lot more on the side of the impermissible.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Professor Resnick. I really enjoyed this conversation with you today. I enjoyed the book. And like I said, I hope that others read it and really get the clear meaning of it and your purpose for it. But again, thank you so much. And I pray that you continue on doing this work that you're doing.
Well, I'm glad to participate and I appreciate your engagement with the book. Thank you very much.
The Hearing.
I found my conversation with Professor Resnick both interesting and enlightening. Her call to upend current punishment practices as a means to prevent lasting injury should resonate with all of us, and it should push us to action. Thank you so much to Professor Resnick for chatting with me, and thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do like and subscribe for more content. And if you want to comment on anything you've heard today, please send us an email at thehearing@thomsonreuters.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.